The following class was led by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 4, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Okay, welcome to, this is meeting 5 of Clear and Obvious Voice Study Group. And nice to see you all here this evening. We're going to just sort of pick up where we left off. I want to move through somewhat quickly. So we were talking about the fifth precept, which is a follower of the way does not intoxicate oneself or others. And then I zeroed in on that word toxic that's at the heart of that word intoxicate. And I reminded us that these precepts have to do with mind. And this class in the past has been taught as the precepts of the one mind. So we're talking about mind. We're talking about totality, reality. And that word toxic, that poison, calls to mind the three poisons. And as I said last class, all these precepts really are about the three poisons. But the next 5, 6 through 10, especially 6 through 9, address specifically the three poisons. So we'll talk about that. And hopefully, as you've been looking through these, you've been able to see that. So just a reminder, those three poisons are greed, anger, and self-delusion. That's the way we translate them here at Dharma Field. And you'll see them translated in a whole lot of different ways, but they'll kind of have that flavor to it. And a reminder that that self-delusion isn't our usual way of understanding self-delusion, but instead is the delusion we have that there's this self that moves through time, that moves through this world, that interacts with a world that's outside of it, perhaps accruing experience. And, you know, it's that self that we can't really locate, but we sure feel like there's something there. We're not quite sure what it is. And really what we're doing is we're just mistaking what that self actually is. We're kind of putting a label on it, putting an understanding on experience. So again, we have the three poisons of mind. And what I didn't share with you last week was something that I know Steve talked about, at least the last time that he taught this, this class. And that is, that the Buddha actually points out in the Dhammapada that freedom from these three poisons, and these three poisons really are just ways in which, we get snagged, by confusion, the ways in which we overlook what it is that's taking place. And as I pointed out last week too about the three, greed, anger, and self-delusion. Self-delusion, you know, as Steve had said last year too, self-delusion seems to be caught up in all of these. So when anger arises, that sense of self arises. When greed arises, that sense of self arises. So in the Dhammapada, he wrote some verses in the chapter on happiness, or in the Iswaran translation, I have joy. And Steve just kind of condensed these verses so that they get right to the heart of the matter. It's let us live happily free from hate. Let us live happily free from strife. Let us live happily free from greed. Let us live happily calling nothing our own. So we can hear in those verses at least the anger and the greed, you know, that Buddha's pointing out. And if we can be free from that, that freedom is happiness or joy. But that happiness or joy is not, again, our usual way of understanding happiness or joy. That is, it's not as opposed to feeling unhappy or feeling sad. This happiness, this joy is actually the, if I could say, the expression of being in agreement with, we'll put it that way, reality, right? Living a life that expresses this moment fully. That's joy. That's release from, freedom from hate, freedom from greed. And in those freedoms, we have freedom from self-delusion as well. So anyhow, I just wanted to retouch that, touch on that again, because we're going to be moving now into these precepts that really are touching on that happiness, that freedom from these three poisons. So the first one that we have then is a follower of the way. This is number 6, a follower of the way does not slander others. And when we look at the Bodhisattva teaching that goes with it really quickly, we see that the teaching is precept of not speaking of the faults of others. And so I was just kind of wondering what people thought about, or, you know, how you, just what your feelings were about that word slander. So we have, again, in the Bodhisattva teaching, or the Bodhidharma teaching, we have that the precept is the precept of not speaking the faults of others. But in the precept that we recite, we say, follower of the way does not slander others. What did you make of that word slander? Did it strike anybody as interesting or not interesting?
Okay.
Go ahead, Mary.
Well, slander implies speaking erroneously.
How so?
Doesn't it?
Explain it. Explain what you mean.
Well, in conventional ways of talking, I thought slander was, I know it's not written.
Right, that's libel.
That's libel.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's making false claims about something someone has done or not done that is somehow a violation of a norm or a rule or a law. I don't know.
Yeah.
And so the precept implies at any talk of the faults of others is erroneous.
Yes.
Any talk.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, thank you. Andrew, what did you want to add?
Hey, everybody. This is Andrew. I remember a Dharma talk that Steve Hagen gave a long time ago. But I remember there was one thing he talked about where he was in some kind of a meeting, and there was a little bit of conflict with all the people in attendance, and it all happened so quickly. And then he tried to describe the situation to somebody who wasn't at that meeting, and immediately he realized that there was really no way to accurately describe it. So when I'm thinking about like slander, based on what Mary was saying there, I was thinking to myself, well, yeah, if you're speaking truths to people or about people, that would be slanderous. But then I was thinking about it on that bigger level, like that story Steve shared, where if slander is kind of like not telling the truth about something, it just seems like, wow, then you're kind of slandering a lot because whatever you're trying to say isn't really right. And that's all I had.
Yeah, that's great. To me, when I was reading this, it did remind me of that fourth precept where Bodhidharma's teaching is to utter a single word, is to speak deceptively. You know, and so when we speak of others, we're already speaking erroneously, as Mary pointed out, because we're already covering over the reality of that person or trying to put them in a box. And Andrew, as you pointed out, what Steve noticed then was he noticed that just in something innocent. I mean, he wasn't even trying to like speak ill of somebody, that he couldn't quite convey what had gone on. You just can't, when you find yourself in that situation, it's really hard to do, which is why I fumble so much in the Zendo when people ask a question and I have to restate it. It's, you know, again, I'm the person for whom, if you were at the silence class last night, you know, that I was, had actually like read a line from the Shinshin Ming that I was going to talk about that I had in my notes, but it was a different translation and I didn't even make the connection. So words can very quickly elude me because of that. Because I remember I had a graduate school professor. Again, I talk about this guy a lot actually, but he was pretty brilliant. But one of the things he would do that annoyed a lot of people was he wrote in this incredibly abstruse fashion. It's just really dense prose. It make you sweat to try to get your way through a sentence. He claimed it was inspired by late career Henry James. So it was just filled with all kinds of like asides. To follow the the thought of a sentence would often require you push out parts of it to try to get at the heart of the sentence first, and then you put all the other stuff back in to try to figure out what he was talking about. And so some critics said to him, Dr. Blau, why do you have to write like that? Couldn't you say it in some other way? And Herb said, in other words, well, he wrote a whole thing, you know, telling the guy, just basically saying the guy was off. And he said, in other words, I would be saying something else. So when you restate something, I'm keenly aware of the fact that once you restate it, you've actually put it in, you've actually changed the meaning of what it was that was originally stated. But this is true of any experience of reality once we put it into words. In that case, it's in other words, but we're doing the same thing. We're paraphrasing. We're taking experience and we're giving it some kind of thing. We're actually changing it. We're altering it in some way. We're limiting it when we're talking about reality, because reality is boundless. And once we start to talk about that. So yeah, thank you, Andrew. I was wondering about that too. It's slander that almost anything we say, you know, is going to be off the mark. And this is particularly true then when we start to pick out the faults of others. And we'll look, as we look at the teachings, about what in particular picking up the faults of others, why that even more so maybe seems to be slander. But I do have a quote from the Buddha that points out something that I think we all know, and that is how easy it is to point out the faults of others. Yes, Andrew, I see your hand is up.
Sorry, just a quick follow-up on what you said there, Steve. Yeah, you know, I think the other thing about the slandering against other people is, you know, if I admit it, you know, yes, I've slandered people before, and immediately when I do so, that whole sense of self is just right there in my face, because typically I'm doing that to make myself feel better or something, or superior, and it's really lame, but yeah, that happens.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. That is a common thing that we do, isn't it? We point out the faults of others, in part because it does make us maybe feel a little better to do that. And it may be that what's actually happening, well, it could be that. It could be that we want to puff our own selves up, so we point out what other people are doing. And then, you know, you might say, well, oh, look at, here's a common one that, say, speeders will do this too. My students would say this kind of stuff, but this is just as great if you've ever been speeding down the highway and then all around you, cars are like passing you, but then you get pulled over by the police, even though you were going 10 miles, 15 miles over the speed limit. And then you go, but everybody else was speeding, right? It's that same sort of thing. Find the faults in others to make yourself feel better, you know, to puff yourself up a little bit, to go, I wasn't really doing anything, but these other people were speeding faster than I do. But we can also see in that, when we see faults in others, that maybe it irritates us, maybe it disturbs us in some way. And so there's something going on, you know, within ourselves that's unsettled, that's uncomfortable, and we want to try to right that in some way. We want to feel better, you know, so we point out the fault. It's that. It's because that person's doing that. That's often the way it shows up. It's because that other person is doing that thing that I'm the way that I am right now. Do you realize that? That if Joe Blow from Kokomo, wasn't whistling that stupid song, you know, I wouldn't right now have stapled my hand to the paper. I wouldn't have done that because he was just bothering, you know, and then there we go. And so that's what we do, is we're feeling uncomfortable, feeling sort of off, maybe a little miserable or irritated or whatever the feeling is, and we're sharing it with others. We're sort of polluting the pool, so to speak, you know, by doing that. I think I've mentioned this before. I worked at this woman. She was one of the most upbeat. I mean, especially when I looked at her life, this is a woman who came from really difficult circumstances. And she was just sunshine when I'd come in on Monday morning, and then I would drip, drip, drip my poison, you know, so that by the end of the week, I would just watch her and she would just be a frazzled mess. And I wasn't doing it on purpose. I was just doing what I do, which is always complaining about things and always pointing out what other people are doing. And I worked with her for a while, and then I realized that always by Friday, she would just be totally off her game. And I started realizing what I was doing. And I went, you know, I'm sure that I contributed greatly to her lack of happiness. And she transferred out, not because she didn't like working with me, but there was something about the job she couldn't put her finger on what it was. It just wasn't the same for her anymore. So she moved to a different department. But, you know, it's easy for us to see the faults of others. And we like to point that out then. It's real easy to do. Harder to see our own. There's a teaching from the Dhammapada, from the section on impurity. And Buddha says, just what I said, it is easy to see the faults of others, hard to see one's own. Like chaff, one winnows others' faults, but one covers up one's own, even as a cheat covers up a losing throw. I really like that image, you know? So if you see what the other people are doing, that's a problem. You can quickly pounce on that. It can be pretty subtle stuff too. But one's own stuff, it's sort of like, you know? And we cover it up in a variety of ways. Sometimes we don't even realize that's what we're doing in what we're saying or doing, but we're actually trying to make ourselves look good. We're trying to cover up what we understand as our own faults. The Buddha continues and says, in one who watches for the faults of others, always ready to take offense or take blame, unwholesome views increase. Such a one is far from the extinction of unwholesome views. Right? So such a one is still, let's say, imbibing one of the three poisons there. So yeah, we sort of looked at what it is that this action does. And it, in some ways it's meant, I think, to appease a sense of unease that we have, but it's not going to do it. We know that, you know, I think as, Andrew had pointed out, a lot of times when we've engaged in behavior like that, there is a sense of remorse that might come from that. Or a sense of, for me, it's just I feel a little sick that I've done it yet again, you know. So, yeah, Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, I was thinking about, I think it relates to what we were talking about with Mary earlier. When you're criticizing someone else, you're suggesting that there is this something amiss in the situation, and you're suggesting to yourself that you can locate this thing that's amiss very precisely in this other being and not in your own being. I'm sure we'll get onto this with the next one, but it reinforces that distinction between self and others that you make if you do this. I used to find this kind of strange, this combination of the two precepts here, because one of the things that I have done a lot of is criticizing the faults of myself while praising others. It's kind of the inverse mistake, but it's actually the same kind of mistake, because it's to locate the fault entirely. You know, if there's something feels amiss, then it's to locate the fault entirely in myself, to say, that's not me, this is me. There's a fault there, or there's a fault here, in itself is untruthful to the situation. And by doing that, you reinforce this kind of fragmented perception of the situation.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. That's fantastic. That's absolutely right. So what it does is it just at a very fundamental level, it's there's the right way, the way things should be, and then there's the wrong way, the way that things seem to be appearing right now, and the way that things should be. And this is the case of shoulds. We should always be aware of this, as I just throw a should in there, but it's never here. Should is always somewhere else. So it is an absolute sign that we're overlooking what's going on. So when we look at what other people are doing, we find fault in it. That has built into it that sense of should. So Richard, I think you're absolutely right. Whether we're criticizing ourselves or whether we're criticizing others, what's really happening is we feel something is missing. We feel that there is a void. And what that comes from, what that arises from, is that strong sense of self and other. So what has happened is our understanding of what's taking place. Now, what's really taking place, of course, is just this. It's boundless. It's seamless. It's a whole. But we've broken it out. And so we have a sense that something is missing. Something's not there. There's a sort of a void. that just comes from an understanding of what it is that's taking place. It sort of feels off to us. Right. And then that's what we do, Richard. Then we start locating things that we can blame. And we, by sort of scolding ourselves, for example, what we're doing is, in a way, we're making ourselves, you know, into something separate. We're engaging in differentiation and separation, and then criticizing that thing that's the self. You know, so it is very similar kind of move. So thanks for sharing. Yes, Andrew.
I was just wondering what people think about this thought. I think it's possible to slander things beyond self and other. I've like recently, like a couple years ago, I moved, and I was slandering the heck out of the new place that I'm living by just kind of layering on top of it a bunch of negative observations and whatever else. And it was definitely affecting the quality of life. And thankfully, I've kind of pulled back from that a little bit. I'm trying to look at more of the positives and look at what's actually happening, not just what I'm conjuring up in my head. But I just was curious about people's idea of, you know, slandering others could be taken even beyond like an animate object, like a human or an animal, but more like just anything.
Anyone have any thoughts? Fiona?
I think what's happening with this precept is we're taking a small version of the reality of something that's happening, and we're taking it out of context. And so in that way, we can do it with just about anything. Within people, we're assuming that we understand their direct experience, so it's very harmful, more so because we're sort of negating the entire person by presuming we know their direct experience and are fully entitled to repeat it and understand it in the way that we think they experienced it, which can never be. But with general slander, for me, it just seems like we focus in on something and then we take it out of context. And that's why it's so difficult to repeat, but it's so much easier to gossip about.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't possibly bring the entire context with it. So we're kind of cheating.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks for sharing. Yeah, all the conditions that are showing up for that event, they're gone. They're just altered is what's happened. So now the conditions are different and we can't bring those other conditions back. Yeah, thanks for sharing. Yeah, I think what we're pointing to here, and Andrew, what you were getting at is captured in Bodhidharma's teaching there. So if we take a look at it, we'll see self-nature is clear and obvious within the flawless Dharma, not speaking erroneously. That's the reason I just asked you to unpack it, because we have the word here, and I just wanted to hear another way of talking about, you know, speaking falsely or speaking in a way that is perhaps in error. It's called the precept of not speaking of the faults of others. So we have this flawless reality, right? So remember that Dharma is reality or mind or totality, and that when we get these seeming characteristics, these aren't characteristics of Dharma. Dharma doesn't have any characteristics. They're the ways in which they help us to see that we overlook this reality. So when he's saying flawless Dharma, what the teaching is helping us to see is that where we're getting caught up is we are perceiving flaws, or we're not perceiving them. We're putting flaws into our experience, and yet our experience itself is flawless. Meaning, if you think about a flaw as like some aspect of a thing that might be broken or might be corrupt in some kind of way. An imperfection, absolutely. But it's like some aspect of it that you can almost point to, you know, that there's something different that's sort of off on it. It could be a mark, it could be a stain. You know, it reminded me of when we talked about the unstained Dharma. Mary, did you want to add?
Discussion of this precept is making me very uneasy.
Yeah.
Because in part it's a precept against complaining. You know, I mean, Andrew did bring that out, And I've learned that any kind of complaining really hurts the other person. I complained to an examiner, hard to explain what that is. This is the person at work who gathers all the information that I then use to make a decision about a claim that I'm reviewing for disability. And this person, I sent this person an email on Sunday about my concerns that the decision by the physician was not correct. And I sent it on Sunday because I didn't want her to process the decision till somebody else had some input in. She went ahead and did it. And I emailed her and I said, I'm just wondering why you decided to ignore my email. And she said, I had a death in the family. And I immediately felt like total, complete shit.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I did.
Yeah.
And so I backed off immediately. And she said, and it had already gone through, already been processed. And I thought, that's it then. That's it. I'm letting it, it needs to be let go.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. But
I don't do this at home necessarily. Like, there's somebody who's supposed to be here who told me they were going to be here and they're not here.
Yeah.
And I just want to go home and complain.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, thanks for sharing that. And that's right. You know, when we engage in that, we're not looking at, it's what Fiona was helping us to see, you know, we're not looking at the whole situation. And so there are times when somebody seems to be misbehaving, and then there's something profoundly, you know, there's some profound suffering. And we want to realize this too. The way I put that maybe is awkward, but we can notice that behavior that we look of. I've spoken of this before, but behavior that we can look at and say, that's not good. That's harmful behavior. That is coming out of suffering. It's not to excuse the actions, but it's to help us to wake up to where this is coming from. And it's coming from this sense, again, and this person is sharing this, that reality is flawed, you know, that there's something flawed about it. But if you think about reality, it can't be flawed because it can't be any other way than this, right? Reality is just, it's all this. It's just all this. So a flaw suggests that some of it's broken or some of it is missing or some of it is, no, it's all of the same flavor. That is the nature of reality. It's flawless. There can't be anything more perfect and perfect in that it just can't be beyond this. It's the way this is beyond, you know, we can't exceed it. So there can't be any excellence that exceeds this. Do you know what I'm trying to say? That this is it. You know, it's fully complete. There's not something missing that, you know, when you think of perfection and this isn't perfect, we think that there's some other place, there's some other way of being, right?
Yeah.
And it simply isn't the case. And so this is perfection. This is flawless. So not speaking erroneously then is just not speaking of the faults of others. So when we engage in that kind of, you know, we can see people doing things where we maybe see that it's harmful, or maybe we are wondering why a person didn't listen.
I did apologize. I felt so terrible. I did apologize profusely and told this person how terribly sorry I was for her loss.
Yeah, and that can be very important when we notice that we've stepped off the path and maybe have harmed somebody just in the way we've interacted with them to say sorry. Yeah, it's a nice thing to do. Richard.
This reminds me of something you were talking about yesterday, I think it was, where you were talking about coming back to the place where suffering is, or coming back to the place of suffering, and how, I mean, the place where I would struggle with this kind of thing is when you see things that are plainly terrible going on. You know, if you watch some of the news stories coming out of the Ukraine war, the suffering is what makes us feel that there's something wrong with the situation, that we feel this, you know, there has to be a way that doesn't involve all this suffering. And so we have a very strong instinct that suffering is the proof that reality is flawed. from there to try to escape to some version of reality that doesn't contain the suffering.
Yeah.
And this seems to be, yeah, this seems to be heading in that kind of location as well. That, you know, the hard thing is to reconcile your sense of how much suffering is being caused by someone's actions, with, what you've just said, that reality is not flawed, but with the flawlessness of the Dharma. We feel that those things are in tension.
Yeah, we think that, yeah, absolutely right. We think those things are in tension and they're not. And I know, Mary, you had asked a question about that too. So that, you're right. You know, it's, we see suffering, we feel suffering. And so then it feels like something is wrong and we can put our finger on it. And to be honest, in a relative sense, we can see behavior that's painful, you know, and we may need to do something about it. It's, can you do it from a place that does not see reality as being flawed, that does not see that person's flawed, that person is somehow inherently evil? Well, I have a friend who uses the word evil where I actually kind of, my heart hurts for him a little bit, because he lives in a world that is filled with evil. It is filled with evil. Not a religious person, so it's not some kind of religious thing. It's a moral, you know, he's a person of very high moral standards. And whew, man, it's rough. So how can we see misbehavior? And that's what he's usually pointing out, or he's really into politics, right? So he's a American studies professor. Well, it's what he does, you know. So he's an American studies professor. He's got a really high degree of moral standards. So I think he's already looking in the wrong arena. and then he sees the behavior that's harmful. And often it does, it's harmful behavior that masquerades as good behavior, right? And it cuts him to the quick, and he refers to other people as evil. Then my question is, can we, and I think what this precept is helping us to see, is can we engage in this world where we all, you know, there's suffering and we act out of our suffering, and so there's harm that's, can we interact with that? Can we engage with faulty behavior without thinking of it as being faulty? Because what Fiona was pointing out too is, if we just keep looking, we'll keep seeing that there are conditions. So you can see, for example, if we think about somebody committing a crime, our tendencies to want to just attack that, the crime, and do something, or maybe put the person in prison or do something to fix that particular problem. But there might be economic conditions in which this person lives that make it conducive for that crime to occur. And those economic conditions also arise from conditions that make it so that those economic conditions exist. And we can keep backing this up, because that is the nature of reality. So when we're looking at things, we keep unwinding them, because we're going to find out that those things, as Richard had pointed out earlier, that that's our flaw, is seeing the things, that seeing those others. And once you see the other, the things that are out there, then you're putting yourself outside of the experience. And so in engaging with this stuff, it's not that suffering and perfection, the perfection of thus, are at intention at all with each other. But it's also not to say that then we walk around saying, oh, it's all perfect. You know, that's just having an idea about reality as well, that it's all perfect, so I don't know, need to do something. I don't know what you need to do. That's going to be your personal, that's part of being here on, you know, in life, is to figure out what it is you're doing. But we can do it from awareness, from awakeness, or not. That's what these precepts help us to see, not what's the right way to do something or the wrong way to do something, but rather, when we are experiencing this reality, can we do this? Can we act? Can we speak? Can we live from awareness? And I think that's really important. And once we do that, when we see that, you know, reality is flawless, and that finding fault in others, finding fault in them, that's a very particular sort of thing. If you think about a fault, I think of like a, you know, like a seismic fault. You know, there's a crack, there's a gap there. And in that gap, there's great violence that occurs as things push together the seismic plates. You know, you can see that. Not seeing that, not seeing the world in that way, is that happiness that Buddha was talking about. This is being caught up in self-delusion. I do want to, it's a great discussion we've been having. I do want to move on because I at least want to get through two more of the precepts. I don't want to rush us, but I at least want to get through two more because that'll allow, you know, then we'll only be like one precept behind. And I use that loosely, but that means next class we'll get to numbers 9 and 10. And then we'll talk about some of the other vows that we'll be taking up in the ceremony. All right. So now we get to, our next precept, which is actually kind of easy to talk about in a way, because as has been pointed out in some of our discussions, these two really do kind of come together. A follower of the way does not praise self. You know, so it comes from that same confusion that we've been talking about with slandering others, which is there's this break between, you know, reality becomes separated. There's this gap between what I think of as myself and then seeing people as being separate from me, right? And so praising self is another way of making ourselves feel better, you know? So when you hear somebody doing that, praising themselves, it can be pretty irritating. We talked a little bit about this last night, I think. You know, it can have an air of, I don't know. It's just, if you've ever heard somebody like talking about the good deeds they've done or, you know, telling you about how they self, it used to actually make me depressed. And then I would get angry at people when I would hear them praising themselves because, you know, I was in teaching profession and teaching is really difficult. So when teachers, when things worked, or even if they just had a good idea, they were willing to share it. And it made me go, man, am I a lousy teacher? These people are so good, you know. But that praising self, you can see that it's such a hard profession that they just wanted that little moment of sunshine, you know. So just to be able to share with other people what it was they did that worked, that made sense. Yeah, Andrew, go ahead.
Just real quick, it's funny. This is very timely for me. At the company I work for, we are now going through the review process, the annual review process. And I just started today doing the dreaded self-assessment. And I was talking to some of my colleagues and we're all just like, I hate doing this. It just feels so grandstanding. it just kind of made me chuckle. That's it.
Thanks for sharing. Yeah. And then you have to do that thing where you go, well, I know that it would not, like if I really talked about the things that I need to improve upon, they would fire me. So how do I spin this in such a way that I make my flaws sound like they're gold, you know?
Exactly right. I haven't gotten to that part of the assessment yet, but you're right.
Yeah, it comes up. Can you just go, I can't tell them that. Right, exactly. So this is, you know, when we are tooting our own horn, it's like slandering others, and that again, we feel this something's off, something's not right, we're uneasy, we're at unrest, and so we praise ourselves. And we know that doesn't last, it just doesn't last. Yeah, that's an endless game that you have to play. Again, what we really need to do is what are we doing? That's where that self-delusion, you know, one of the three poisons, that's where that. This, you know, where we can really see what's going on there when we're praising ourselves is where in a way, coddling isn't the right word because I don't think it's necessarily that, that kind of activity, but it's rather, we're trying to protect and, I don't know, protect that self. Did you see a hand up? Or,
well, yeah, I've often wondered whether this precept is at odds with psychology, you know, which operates out of a sense of self. But, you know, like if someone suffers from low self-esteem, then a therapist or a psychologist might say, well, let's enumerate your good qualities. You know, and so then I wondered, well, is that a violation of this precept?
Well, again, we don't want to think of this in terms of violation, You know, and I do want, but Mike, I do want to reiterate, because this is really important. We don't violate these precepts.
Okay.
No, we don't. And so, you know, what we do is, if we realize that we're praising self, for example, we just realize we stepped off the path. It's not really a violation. It's just now what is really kind of what we do is now what.
But it is stepping off the path.
Yeah, but it's not a violation. Okay. So on one hand, I say, just now what? So let's say I don't know. The problem is that what I would hesitate to do is say that kind of action that you were just talking about is a violation in and of itself of this person. I don't know if it is or not. You know, the way we live our life is, as Norm points out, it's case by case. You know, so we really can't come up with like, well, if I do this, then I'm straying off the path. Well, only when you strayed off the path have you strayed off the path, and then you're just to notice that has occurred, and then you can just get back on the path again. So I do know what your question is asking is, doesn't psychology seem to be at odds with this? Well, psychology is about ego, self, you know, so possibly. Yeah. But can you enumerate perhaps for yourself, if you're suffering from, you know, narratives that you tell yourself that are harmful, can you do this in such a way that's not going to solidify that sense of division between you and the world, right? That to me is when, you know, when we're talking about the self-delusion, that's the problem, is there is a gap. There is a sense of, a real strong sense of being separate from the world. And I can tell you the flip side of that, no matter how much you beef that sense of self up, is a sense of potential alienation. It'll arise. You'll feel separate from that world that's separate from you, because that's how you're conceiving reality, is that it's outside of you, that it's somehow something you're going to have to reach out for. So just be aware, if you are, you know, working, just to work on seeing that gap and realizing that this experience right now, that's true nature, you know, that is true self, that what we start to put a label on of whatever we mean when we talk about self, that's really just us putting some kind of conceptual idea on reality. And once we've done that, we know it's limited. So we can work with that. We can understand that whatever we're working on in our therapy, maybe, there's limits to it if we have ideas about it, if we have a sense of boundaries, if we have, and it, not that that's wrong that it's got limits. But again, what we usually do is we take a limited view of reality and we see it, or we understand it as the way things are. We don't understand the limits to the limits, right? We don't understand that that's just a fragmented way of seeing. As long as we can be aware of that, those limited ideas, those concepts, they are how we get through the world. So we have to be able to function in this world. We have to have ideas. We may have to work on ourselves. We may be in a place where we need to work on it. But can we do that again in a way that is not going to be harmful? You know, can we do that in a way that sees the situation as it is, which is just this, as reality? So, right, I don't want to dwell too much on praising self, so we'll look at Bodhi Dharma's teaching here. He says self-nature is clear and obvious. And again, when self-nature is not clear and obvious to us, it's when we're caught up in self. And the reason why is, again, when we're caught up in that little self, when I say little self, but when we're caught up in self, we're caught up in a perspective, and suddenly there's a whole lot of mystery out there, because we think we know how things are. And then things arise that aren't at all like we think that it is. So we can realize the self nature is clear and obvious. Here it is. This is it right here within the undifferentiated Dharma. So again, you know, we had the last one was flawless, and we're talking about how those flaws differentiate between flawed and unflawed reality. So within the undifferentiated Dharma, without distinguishing between self and other, without distinguishing between self and that, is called the precept of not praising oneself. So that praising self is rooted in and helps to maintain that sense of self and other. And so we can see how these two, slandering others and praising self, other, in some ways, very similar kinds of activities. Yeah, Fiona.
Yeah, I think you really hit on it, the concept of separating, you know, and the stories we're telling ourselves about separating, and they're actually causing suffering, not eliminating. But these two precepts to me are actually two sides of the same coin. In the one, you're stepping yourself up to separate from others. And in the other one, you're pushing everyone down to separate yourself from others. So yeah. you're just going in two different directions and how you achieve that separation.
Yeah.
And then the separation itself negates the whole truth that it's impossible to be separate.
Yeah.
And hence, you know, everything that goes with that.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, that's absolutely right. So then we think about your diagram, and we've got that circle that goes around, you know, and we keep swirling around truth as we get caught up in that. We never quite get to it. So, all right. Well, that's fantastic. Anything else anyone wants to say about that precept, or should we move on? All right. So this is a follower of the way does not possess anything selfishly. And so one of the things that I had pointed out last class was that these numbers 6 through 10, these precepts were precepts that were traditionally taken up by monks. And there is actually a narrower understanding that this precept had that I want to share with you. And that is that one must not be avaricious in the bestowal of teachings and materials. So the thing that's being possessed selfishly in particular was the teachings and the materials. Excuse me, that the teacher or the follower of the way is set up as some kind of authority, which of course you want to be wary of, because really the teacher doesn't have anything that you don't already have. They have a practice, perhaps, that is their own, but they don't have anything you don't have. And so they're just pointing to reality. They're helping you to see that, but they don't have anything. So they're not some kind of authority that has something that a teacher might then possessively hold on to these teachings and hold back in some way. And a way that I can imagine that might be, well, some people are allowed to take up this way and some people aren't. Some people should take up this way and some people shouldn't. And this teaching really is offered in this way. If you want to follow this way, if you see that there's, you know, something there that you want to pursue, you know, take up this teaching. And so teachers just offer in that spirit that anyone who wants to be a part of this is welcome to be a part of it in a way we all are. Whether we take up this way or not, we're all part of this life that's unfolding. So, so that was the initial way that it was to be understood. And same thing with students then, hanging on to teachings. We all know the metaphor that Buddha offered for his teachings, that his teachings were a raft that just helped you cross a river. And of course, you know, we've talked with a couple of people here at Dharma Field about how limited even an image like that is, because that makes it sound like, well, you're one place and you're trying to get to another place. And then you'll see teachings that try to say, you're already on the other side of the river. None of that matters. What really matters right now is what Buddha really was trying to point out. And this is very important, is that these teachings, and this is something that arose in my silence class a few weeks ago, is that the Buddha's teachings are all about helping us to wake up. That's it. They just have that purpose. So we don't hang on to them. So same thing with a teacher doesn't have these things and then holds on to them and then lets some people have it and not let other people have it. A student also doesn't hang on to these teachings and then just hang on to them, you know, and start accumulating things. And then you're like Steve Martin at the end of the movie, The Jerk, when he's leaving this house and he's got nothing. He's going to leave everything behind. And he says, well, except for this paddle ball and paddle, you know. So he takes the paddle ball and paddle, and he starts to leave. He goes, well, except for this paddle ball and paddle and this coffee mug. And then he grabs a coffee mug. And he goes, okay, except for this paddle ball and paddle, this coffee mug and this chair. And he grabs, you know, so we don't want to be like that. We don't treat the teachings like that, where we start accumulating things and suddenly we got our arms full of stuff, metaphorically speaking, right? Yeah, Mary.
This reminds me of the story of the koan about Yakusan that you told at the end of the class last night. The director somehow perceived Yakusan's ascending the seat to give a talk and just sitting there and then descending and leaving as though Yakusan were withholding something.
Yeah.
And yet it was really an act of generosity.
Yeah.
That, because he really seemed to have a great deal of equanimity, and he was showing his students what that looked like.
Yeah.
Without actually saying anything and maybe disturbing their minds. I don't know, but that, this reminds me of that. He was actually very generous rather than avaricious.
Yeah. Yeah. So Mary was talking about a story I told last night about Yakusan, and he hadn't spoken for a while at his center. So he was asked by the director to give a talk. And he said, go ahead and ring the bell. And they rang the bell. And then he walked up to his podium, sat down, sat there for a while. And then he got up and he walked off. And then the director said, I thought you were going to say at least a word, right? And what Mary's saying is that this reminds us of this. That was a very generous act on Yakusan's part. He wasn't withholding anything at all. In fact, he was revealing right there what the truth is. So, yeah, we have that. That narrower sense. And now we have a broader sense. We can see actually how we can possess anything selfishly in that way. That is, first of all, a sense of self that I have this thing, you know, that this is mine and you can't have it. Like, I know I brought up Lammy now a few times, you know, Lammy is my toy and you can't have Lammy. But that, you know, possessing something that it's mine, but you also think about the object. We're making a self out of that object. We're giving it selfhood. And we're saying, you can't have that. You know, we're seeing a misconception about the things that arise that are this experience. So there are these appearances that show up and go away. They show up and we go, and then we see things being here for a while. Like we start to, when we separate things out and we have things like Lammy or whatever it might be a friendship. And then we try to make it kind of solid. Maybe you have, you know, getting back to slandering others, you might have ideas about how this person's supposed to be. You know, Richard, you don't behave like that. That's not how this works. You're not supposed to be like that. Whatever it is. So we can do this with things. We can do with friendships, we can do with feelings, we can do with hopes and aspirations. We make things out of them that we think then they have this kind of non-fluidity to them. We think that this is the way that things are. They're going to be here. We might not think forever, but we may not be thinking at all like that. Like, well, this will last X amount. We're just treating it at that moment like it is something that is lasting and that is not constantly in flux and constantly needs our attention. And so when we possess something selfishly, that's what we're doing. We're breaking our experience into a solid me and a solid thing that I'm possessing. Yeah, Andrew, go ahead.
What you just said, that's great. That was what I was aiming at when I mentioned the labels and beliefs that I was slapping all over the place that I currently live.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I was doing.
Yeah, absolutely. We do that all the time. Thanks for sharing, Andrew. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's very easy to do. We get caught up in how we conceive, to use a word that we use a lot, how we conceive what's going on, but it's just our ideas about what's going on. We get caught up in those and we act out of them. So again, as we're living our life, that's what these precepts help us to see. How is our action showing up in such a way that helps us to see that we're doing that, that we're actually living out of ideas of reality rather than just allowing reality in its constant flow to be what it is, right? To just let this be. Just this is it. So, right, that's the thing about possessing things. And, you know, I like that word possessing, too, because it has this other suggestion of being possessed. You know, if we think about why it is that we possess things selfishly, it gets back to suffering. It gets back to that sense of something's missing, doesn't it? And then, so just as we can look out in the world and start blaming things, we can also look out in the world and go, that is the thing. If I have that, and again, it can be a relationship, it can be some kind of object we can have, it could be an experience. If I could just go up to the Boundary Waters right now, how lovely it would be. And then you get up there and there's snow all over the place. You're like, well, those would be like this, right? But whatever it is, we get possessed by it in a way. We think it's going to solve our problems. It's going to ease that ache of the heart that Steve talks about, you know, that deep ache of the heart. We think it's going to solve that. And so we possess it and we do it in that way because we think it's going to help us in some way. And we even maybe try to protect that thing if we don't do what we tend to do when we get that thing we finally wanted. Maybe we have some pleasure in it for a while. And then it ends up going in the bottom drawer under other things and you close it. Or, you know, I know I've shared the story about when I was a kid and I'd get Slinkies, you know, and be so excited because Slinkies were, I don't know, they were so cool. I didn't really like the way they smelled, but I liked the sound they made and I liked the feel of them. You try to get them to go down the stairs and they wouldn't really go down the stairs the way they did in the advertisements. And that was kind of frustrating. And then they wouldn't do some of the other things. And then next thing you know, it'd be all tied up in knots. And you'd just try to hide it so grandma wouldn't spank you for breaking yet another Slinky. But you know, when I think about it, they weren't that expensive. I don't know why grandma gets so bent out of shape about that. But anyhow, these things, that's the nature of them, is they possess us for a while. And then we realize that all things arise and they cease. And the way we usually take it is something I can grab hold of and hang on to and protect from that. That's just not how reality works. And when we do that sort of thing, when we think there are things out there that can make us feel better, we become dependent on those things, right, to make us feel better. We become dependent on our relationships with our friends to make us feel better. We become dependent on that cigarette or that beer. Or we become dependent on the crossword puzzle or Wordle. Darn you, Wordle, I didn't get it in six tries. Whatever it is, you know, whatever the thing is, we become dependent on that.
You're cutting too close to the bone.
But, you know, it should be, I mean, heck, I do that. I'm a Wordle player and I've had one where I didn't get it. You know, I got four of the five letters. And then it was just a matter of figuring out what the fifth letter was going to be. And I was like, this isn't even fun, you know, because it could be one of about 20 words and I just couldn't do it. But anyhow, I'm really talking about how we then depend on, and notice we're depending on other. So it is sort of that worldview and we're kind of carrying that worldview out. We're making it alive in a way by doing that, by acting in a way that is coming from that particular way of seeing things. All right, so we did largely get through this. So next time we'll get through numbers 9 and 10. We also will talk about Bodhidharma's teachings on this this precept. And then we'll talk about the formless admission and the three pure precepts as well. And I'll talk a little bit about the ceremony. So we've got a kind of a full session next time, but I think we can do it. So great to see you all. Thanks for participating. The conversation was great. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.